Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, Alicia Malone with Scott Movie Mance and the Schmoes Know. This is Profiled. In-depth spotlights on the greatest filmmakers and artists in motion picture history.
Hello, Profilers.
Yes, as you can tell by our attire, because we're not wearing baggy t-shirts, we are profiling the most successful, the longest-running, continuing film series in motion picture history, Bond, James Bond.
Yes, and I wanted to wear a tux, but I didn't get my act together in time to find one. So I've decided I'm not a Bond girl. I am a Bond villain disguised as a Bond girl.
But Red Fury sound like a great Bond villain, right?
Red Fury.
You know, who needs Honor Blackman when you've got Alicia Malone as a Bond villain?
Yes. And you've got Red Fury.
Red Fury. I must be dreaming.
Sounds wrong. Well, James Bond, I mean, such an interesting character. The most famous fictional spy around, the M16 agent, 007. Created, of course, by Ian Fleming. And as you said, the longest running franchise, also the third highest grossing movie franchise ever, 24 official movies in total over 5 decades, and over $5 billion when you adjust for inflation.
When you adjust for inflation. Actually, when you look at the number of novels that Ian Fleming wrote, there were just 12 of them.
Yeah.
And there were 24 official movies, two of them unofficial, like Never Say Never Again, and the other version of Casino Royale. But this is a character, this is a spy that has not just thrived, but endured and evolved. I mean, what's your take on why this character has stayed so relevant over the past 53 years?
Well, it's kind of an amazing gift that they ended up changing actors, because every time they bring in a new actor, it gives it a whole new fresh feel.
Yeah.
6 actors in total. Of course, I'll always love Sean Connery. It's my favorite, but I do like what they've done with the franchise to move with the times. It's so fun as well. I mean, it's interesting when you watch all these movies again, and we'll talk about this during the show, but you watch it and you go, okay, a lot of these are very much of their time, particularly with the treatment of women.
Yes.
Not always the best in that respect, but they do have a lot of fun things going on. The gadgets, the martinis.
The quotes,
the glamorous lifestyles, the exotic location, the evil villains in the hilarious lairs and the henchmen, and of course Austin Powers did it so well, making parodies of this.
Not only have you had so many spy movies and spy characters that were influenced by James Bond, like Mission Impossible back in the 60s, and of course the movies, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. back in the 60s and that movie as well, but you have the spoofs like Austin Powers and even Spy with Melissa McCarthy, which was a big hit over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But it all comes back to Bond. This is a character that's been played officially 6 times by 6 different actors, always reinventing himself, staying current, staying fresh, and always acknowledging the changing of the times. Like in GoldenEye, when M, played by Judi Dench for the first of 7 times, was telling Pierce Brosnan's Bond, "You're a relic. The Cold War is over." But they reinvented that character again, and they did it again amazingly with Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, and again with Skyfall, and again with Spectre, which we won't spoil anything for the people who haven't seen Spectre yet, but I thought one thing I liked about it was the way that they looked at the modern themes mixed with the classic old Bond.
And also, that was a film that tied together all of Daniel Craig's adventures as James Bond, while maybe leaving the door open for a fifth one that he may or may not do. Who knows?
Who knows?
But if he does end at 4, he would tie with Pierce Brosnan, who also did 4 films. But, you know, a lot of people I noticed, especially on Facebook and on Twitter, a lot of them picked their favorite Bond, not movie, but their favorite actor to play Bond was contingent on the one that they grew up with.
Mm.
So where does that leave you with just your favorite Bond?
Well, technically, I should be like Timothy Dalton or Pierce Brosnan, but I have to say I love Sean Connery, probably because that was the first Bond film I'd ever seen. My first Blood was Dr. No.
That was your first Blood?
Yeah, I'm sure I saw bits of Timothy Dalton or Pierce Brosnan here and there, but Dr. No is the first Bond film I remember seeing from start to end.
How?
And I loved it. Just growing up in a house where we watched a lot of classic movies.
So it was not in the cinema.
It wasn't in the cinema. It was either on TV or on VHS. I can't remember which one. But I remember sitting down and watching it all. And so I think that's why Sean Connery will always be my favorite James Bond.
Well, I'm in a minority here because my favorite James Bond is the one that I grew up with. That would be Roger Moore. I mean, you know, I don't think Roger Moore gets the credit that he deserves because a couple of his films were a little too cheesy. There was too much of a wink.
Yeah.
But the first James Bond movie, my first blood, was The Spy Who Loved Me, 1977. And, you know, this was a time when I saw Star Wars, Close Encounters. I thought all movies were supposed to be like that. I didn't realize that The Spy Who Loved Me was the biggest Bond they had ever done in terms of production up to that point. Of course, mm-hmm. they would top it, you know, the following 2 years with Moonraker. But I loved Roger Moore. I thought he was a dangerous Bond, but I also thought that he was having fun with it. And he was charming and he was suave.
Very tongue-in-cheek.
Very tongue-in-cheek. And I like that because in the end, you can't take this stuff too seriously.
No.
And for, let's see, 77, an 8-year-old, it was the perfect kind of film to introduce me to Bond. And the funny thing is about that movie was I saw it with my parents at the Eric Baderwood Theater just outside Philadelphia. And we were standing in line back when you had to wait in line for tickets.
Yeah.
And I had to go to the bathroom really bad. So I went in the theater. The guy let me in. And while I was in the theater, I peeked in and I saw the end of the film. And I was like, I walked outside. I said to my dad, I said, why is he making out with a girl in a little boat? And he's like, son! Like, he was so disappointed that I blew the ending.
That is so funny. Well, a lot of people watching live on YouTube say that their first blood was GoldenEye, so that Pierce Brosnan was their first Bond.
Interesting.
Although Giant Duan, I hope I say that rightly, said, my first Bond movie was Octopussy. Which is great.
1983.
Timothy Huzak says, License to Kill is a badass movie. And Bill Pollahan, he says Goldfinger is his favorite.
There you go. Everybody's got a favorite Bond, a favorite movie. Just goes to show you just how the characters just appeal to so many people, and these movies have appealed to so many people over the years.
Yeah.
But that brings us to number 5 on our Fast Five for James Bond, which is...
You did want me to drop in.
The Spy Who Loved Me, just what we were just talking about. Released in the UK on July 13th, 1977. Directed by Lewis Gilbert, who directed 3 James Bond films. The cost of this movie for 1977, a very big deal, cost more than Star Wars, was $14 million. Total worldwide box office was $186 million. 3 Oscar nominations for this one, including Song, Score, and Art and Set Decoration.
Well, the song Nobody Does It Better.
It's one of the best.
By Carly Simon. And one of the best and one of the few to not feature the film's title as its chorus line.
Right.
You know,
and I was like, actually, that was the thing. It's like during the credits, which I saw before the rest of the movie, because my mom was singing the song in the car on the way. I'm like, what are you singing? And then I realized she was singing the Bond theme. But, you know, a lot of people do feel, and we got this on Facebook too, a lot of people feel, and I've read a lot, that their favorite James Bond with Roger Moore was For Your Eyes Only. Because mm-hmm. after the big spectacle that was Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only brought Bond back to basics. It made him get real and gritty again, just like the Connery days. But the great thing about The Spy Who Loved Me is it has all that, and it does have the spectacle and the gadgets and the underwater lair.
Oh, I know. It's got some cheesy one-liners in there. Like that one, tell him to pull out immediately.
Yeah, right.
Cut to James Bond with a girl. It's got the Bond girl, Agent Triple X.
Agent Triple X, played by...
What a name!
Future Mrs. Ringo Starr, Barbara Bach.
She was a good villain. In the opening scene how Bond is with a girl and then it cuts to her and she's with a guy. She is one of the few that was his equal sexually, I think. You know, she had her own thing going on. She was also had the capability. She was also an agent, a KGB agent. So she matched him in that way, and this was during, you know, women's liberation, so you could see women that have a bit more sexual power out there. I like the ski chase scene.
The ski chase scene is fantastic.
It's amazing. I love the big free fall, and then the Union Jack comes up at the end.
You just brought me to my right stuff, but we'll get to that in a second. But you know what this movie has, Leash? Jaws.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say.
Jaws! It has Richard Kiel as Jaws.
This is the introduction of the ultimate Bond henchman, Jaws, who chews sharks with steel teeth, and it hasn't really been matched in terms of Bond henchman, I don't think. For me, no. He is the ultimate one.
Like, when you think of Bond henchman, you think of Odd Job,
mm-hmm.
and you think of Jaws.
Jaws, yeah.
And, you know, Jaws had a bigger role in the film that followed, Moonraker. But this movie was almost directed by Steven Spielberg. They approached him to direct it, but at the time, he was still in post-production on another movie, and he wanted to see how, quote-unquote, that little fish film would do at the box yeah. office.
And it did really, really well,
it did
obviously.
Very well. Yes.
I think that this is one of the new movies you could watch. If you wanted to see one Bond film and you'd only seen Austin Powers movies,
yeah.
you could watch this one. It almost has all the elements that they make fun of in the Austin Powers, but it embraces the silliness and it has a lot of fun with it. That's what I like.
And you have a villain who wants to start a whole new civilization underwater.
Yeah.
And then in the next film, you have a villain who wants to start a whole new civilization in space.
I know. And I love Stromberg, the villain, how he lets people out the trapdoor to the sharks underneath.
Well, they apparently were going to, that was supposed to be Blofeld. But I think they just got tired of using both and just wanted to do a different thing. Interestingly, The Spy Who Loved Me was the very last film that Elvis Presley saw before he passed away in August 1977. That's very, very interesting trivia.
That is interesting.
And Isaac Sage, a profiler, says, Spy Who Loved Me found a perfect balance between the Austin Powers-ish tone of the later Moore films, which you just pointed out, and the genuine fun of the Connery films. Jaws is a fantastic henchman, second only to Odd Job. And Barbara Bach's XXX is stunning and smart. A perfect Bond girl. Also, Stanley Kubrick ghost-directed a scene in the film, according to a rumor, and you can't go wrong with that. I didn't know
really?
That.
Really? I didn't
That's
know that.
That's a good rumor. That's a good rumor.
I wonder which scene that was. Well, speaking about right stuff, is that your one,
yeah,
the ski scene?
Yeah, well, the ski scene, I was going to go with the ski scene on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yep.
But the ski scene in For Eyes Only did top that because he goes off the cliff. There's no music.
Yeah.
And it's all like in real time. There's no cuts to it.
Free falls a long way.
That scene, they waited for 10 days before the right weather conditions allowed them to shoot it. The scene alone cost $500,000 to make. And because I thought that you might go with that scene, my backup scene for Right Stuff was the scene in the beginning of For Your Eyes Only,
mm-hmm.
where Moore's Bond turns the tables on Blofeld with the helicopter and drops him in the factory chute. I
yeah.
thought that was really great. What's your Right Stuff?
My Right Stuff is actually a more recent one from Casino Royale. The opening scene, the parkour chase scene in Madagascar in Africa, because that really, to me, signaled a brand new Bond, grittier Bond, more realistic Bond, but still exciting, still thrilling, still in an exotic location. But it was our first look at Daniel Craig as James Bond, and he was relentless in his pursuit of this henchman and just jumping from crane to crane. And it was just, for me, being scared of falling and scared of heights, I thought it was really scary, but it was so exciting, an exciting action set piece.
Well, after 53 years, 24 official films, we could just have a last detail for 2 hours just on James Bond. But tell me some of the interesting details that you discovered in your research for James Bond profiles.
Well, I didn't realize that James Bond was actually never Scottish until Sean Connery played him in the role. And then they made his background to be Scottish for Sean Connery. And that exists even today. They talk about in Skyfall, they talk about his Scottish history.
Well, did you know, Alicia, that Dr. No, when it had its UK premiere on October 5th, 1962, it was the same exact day that the Beatles released their very first single, Love Me Do. So you have James Bond and the Beatles. Both got their start on the same day. The two biggest exports since, like, people came to America.
Yeah.
And they both happened on the same day. And they're both enduring to this day. I think that's really cool.
I knew it would be something with the Beatles. Did you know that the character was named James Bond after an ornithologist? Ian Fleming thought it was the dullest name he'd ever heard, so he wanted something that was just very flat and very unassuming.
He actually, his quote to that, because I had the same thing, of course, he said, quote, I wanted him to be a blunt instrument. When I was casting around for a name, I thought, by God, James Bond is the dullest name I ever heard. Well, another thing that's kind of interesting around the time, and this is before the first James Bond movie, even a film, is that JFK, John F. Kennedy, was a fan of the novels, and at a party in 1960 with Ian Fleming, he asked Ian Fleming for some advice on how to defeat Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he was joking or not, but he responded with a plan to irradiate his beard. So he would have to shave off the beard. Castro would have to shave off the beard, and he would lose like that mojo that he had with his followers. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's true, but it's a good talking point.
Well, did you know that Bond has killed 362 people on screen? That's not including Spectre. So, because this was counted before Spectre, I'm not sure how many he killed in Spectre. But who do you think was the deadliest Bond of all?
The deadliest
killed
Bond of all?
Killed the most. Which actor?
I'm going to go with Brosnan.
Yeah, Pierce Brosnan.
How many?
Four films, and he killed the most. I didn't write down exactly how many, but he killed the most out of any Bond.
You know, his movies are so... They were so consistently the four films that Pierce Brosnan did. I think they get overlooked, and I think we definitely got to show love to Pierce Brosnan with his movies, particularly GoldenEye. And I did like Die Another Day, even though it was a bit over the top. But let's take a break for 1 second just to take care of some very, very important business.
Go for it.
Okay, this is important. Just like you have helped continue James Bond for 53 years, please help us continue Profiles for the next 53 years. And the only way to do that is by going to iTunes and subscribing to Profiles on iTunes, and make sure you rate and review us on iTunes so we can get back on the film and TV podcast lists. So be sure to do that, and go to youtube.com/Popcorn Talk Network. Subscribe to our YouTube version. Share our YouTube version of Profiles with your friends so people can really catch on. Let's make Profiles go viral. Go to our Facebook page, which is Profiles with Malone and Mance. Like our Facebook page so that you can see, well, first of all, who we're profiling next, but also join in on the fun, and you can see that we're reading comments from people who chime in on their favorite movies. And make sure that you also chime in with going to tpublic.com/user/profiles and get your Profiles t-shirts.
Yes, that's right.
Because we sure have a whole bunch of them to sell, and they're all really, really cool.
Now here
and
it comes.
Definitely make sure you follow us on Twitter at Alicia Malone, at Movie Mance, at Alicia Malone, at Movie Mance, at Alicia Malone, at Movie Mance.
Sorry if I'm wearing headphones.
It is all about the pause.
All right. Well, let's keep going with our Fast Five. At number four is...
You're one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen.
I think my mouth is too big.
No, it's the right size.
Oh!
For me, that is.
From Russia with Love.
Yeah.
Great film. I watched it again over the weekend. It holds up so, so well, even though it's from Russia with Love. Released on October 11th, 1963 in the UK. Came out in April 64 in the USA. Cost $2 million compared to almost $300 million for Spectre, but it cost $2 million, which was double the budget of Dr. No. Total box office worldwide, this is 1963, $78.9 million worldwide.
Wow.
That is a lot of money. Directed by Terrence Young, who directed three Bond movies, including Dr. No, and just John Barry's score throughout the series up until he passed away is just fantastic.
The classic Bond theme. I mean, this was the second Bond, of course, the second one with Sean Connery. And in this one, Spectre wants to avenge the killing of Dr. No. They set Bond up with a Russian consulate clerk to steal something, a ledger. I don't even really know what that is.
It's a MacGuffin.
But the henchman is Red Grant, who is also a great henchman because he really could stand up to James Bond. And I love the scene, obviously, the big fight scene on the train, on the Orient Express. It's awesome to watch.
It's awesome. It keeps going.
Keeps going.
And the thing about From Russia with Love is you know, it was the second film, so they were starting to they were still on the rise.
They were starting to develop that template.
That template, you have Q with some gadgets. You have the opening.
That was the first time we saw Q.
The first time, Desmond Llewellyn, he played Q, I think, 17 times
with very lo-fi gadgets like the briefcase.
Yeah, but it was still setting up the gadgets. And the thing about Connery as Bond in that film is it was a raw performance. You know, Bond was dangerous but still charming.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gritty physical film performance. It established Bond as a man of action. I'm obviously a man of romance as well. Smooth, charming, and dangerous. And again, the fight scene with Red on the train with Red Grant. And This is actually, of all the films that he did as Bond, it was Connery's personal favorite.
And it's also pretty a low-key plot, even. It feels more like a Hitchcock or inspired or a John le Carré novel.
Yeah, totally.
Something
does.
That's like more kind of self-contained than the big flashy Bond scenes. But of course they have Spectre, and if you've seen Austin Powers, then that's where they get like number 3, number 5.
And he's got the cat, but Spectre, but Blofeld had hair.
What's it called? The knife in the shoe?
Yeah.
Kick. But it's pretty brutal at times, this movie.
Can you imagine, like now that we've rewatched so many of these movies, going back and rewatching Austin Powers?
I want to now.
I know. Like, it would actually be really, really
just
funny.
Just reminds you of all the things.
Well, From Russia with Love is the last James Bond film that Ian Fleming ever saw. And Time Magazine, in their review back in 1964, said it was a fast, smart, truly directed and capably performed Bond movie. And it definitely deserving so many people. Even my dad, I remember years and years ago, he said how much he loved From Russia with Love. It was his favorite film.
It's a cat and mouse game. And I think something that reminds me of Hitchcock is the helicopter chase scene. Feels a little bit North by Northwest.
It definitely does.
Yeah, it feels like it's inspired by that. And you know, as we're saying, this is Bond film before it, the template, which really, really defined it. But I really enjoyed watching it. I hadn't seen this movie in a long time.
Me neither.
I'd only seen it once before.
Me too.
And I really liked watching it again.
Well, Sam Hollis feels that From Russia with Love too often goes unmentioned in the discussion of Sean Connery's Bond films and Bond films in general. It introduces many of the elements that became iconic to Bond and the spy genre. It also features, in my opinion, Connery's best performance as Bond and one of my personal favorite henchmen and henchwoman in Red Grant and Rosa Klebb.
Yeah.
The plot feels grounded, intricate, and raw. If Hitchcock ever made a Bond film, you just talked about him, I believe From Russia with Love would have been the closest to his interpretation, as it feels mysterious and suspenseful, and it is beautifully shot. Thank you, Profiles, Malone and Nance. I appreciate your opinions and positive presentation of brilliant films so much.
Oh, thanks, Sam. And Morgan Robinson says, From Russia with Love is something else entirely to me. I don't know whether it's just me, but this is such an entertaining and brilliant film. Connery, by far the best Bond, is at his best. Tatiana, the Bond girl, is one of the more memorable, even though she can't compete in terms of name with Pussy Galore or Honey Rider. And Lott as the ruthless Rosa Klebb is outstanding. Then, of course, we get to Red Grant, played by the wonderful Robert Shaw, who is such a brutal villain that the only time you ever feel Bond might lose is when he fights Grant on the Orient Express.
Well, what would a James Bond movie be without a great James Bond theme?
Yeah.
That brings us to our best Bond themes. What are your favorites?
Goldfinger.
Goldfinger.
It's my favorite. Shirley Bassey. So big and bold and brassy, and it just really suits that movie so much.
I just love that call and playback, you know, yeah. Goldfinger. Well, of course, you know what I'm going to say here.
Yeah, the Paul McCartney one.
Yes, yeah. Live and Let Die. Now, here's the thing. Live and Let Die is the best Bond theme song, in my opinion, because it's the only one that really, really rocks. Mm-hmm. It was produced by George Martin, who produced all the Beatles songs. This is one of Paul McCartney's best songs, as good as anything he ever did with the Beatles. He's been performing this song live as a showstopper, you know, close to the end for his encore, since 1975. Oh, every time, you know, the whole stage just, like, you know, ignites on fire. It's so great.
Yeah, it's a great song. A View to a Kill. What about Duran
Duran?
Duran
Duran! I love Duran Duran. Let's give it up for Duran Duran.
1985, and the bassist from Duran Duran approached Cubby Broccoli at a party and was like, why don't you ever get some popular musicians to do a theme song? So then they did that one.
Well, I know we talked about it just a bit, cool. But nobody does it better.
Carly Simon.
Like you said, the first Bond theme that didn't have the title of the film as a title of the song. It's such a great melody, great lyrics, and I think it's the best sort of traditional Bond theme when you think of just, you know, the slower songs. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, Live and Let Die is not a slow song, but what else?
What about Diamonds Are Forever?
Shirley Bassey again.
Second time doing a Bond theme. That was from 1971.
Yep.
Another big, brassy, bold theme that just I love hearing and pumping up loud.
What was her third?
Oh, it was forgotten.
Moonraker!
Oh, that's right, Moonraker.
Moonraker sounds a lot like Goldfinger! I love Skyfall.
Skyfall!
Jeez. So Adele. Many great things to say about Skyfall.
And she reminds me of Shirley Bassey with that voice that she has, so powerful.
Absolutely killed it. It was a throwback to the best of Shirley Bassey, which was always the best.
That opening credit scene is brilliant, too.
We were at that screening, which was at the, it was at the Grove in, like, October of 2012.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just remember watching that movie, you know, just even, you know, the opening credits were great with the whole take the shot thing. And then when they played the opening theme and, you know, with the titles and, you know, the...
And going into the water.
It was like, I just was sitting forward go, now this feels like a Bond film.
Yes.
So great. Awesome.
So
many others, but we got to move on.
Our Fast Five number three is...
This never happened to the other fella.
Yes, I was hoping you would use that one. High five right here. Yes, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, released December 18th, 1969, directed by Peter Hunt. His only Bond film, cost $7 million to make. Box office was $65 million worldwide. Bit of a dip compared to some of the other films, but still pretty damn impressive. Golden Globe nomination for most promising newcomer, George Lazenby, who was the youngest actor to ever play Bond at 29 years old.
Yeah, and the second actor. This was the first time they switched the sixth Bond film in the franchise, and this is the Aussie Bond. He's an Australian unknown actor and model who came into this role and had big shoes to fill with Sean Connery, but this movie is incredible. I mean, I think it's one of the best written movies. It's
Definitely.
Got the most interesting plot. It's got Blofeld. It's got the fembots, like the agents of death.
Sure,
Blofeld wants to poison the world's food supply, which doesn't quite make sense. But this is the one where Bond marries and he cries. And it's the most romantic Bond, and I think the most emotional performance from Bond until Daniel Craig with Casino Royale.
Absolutely. Well, I was going to go one step further than that and say it's the most personal James Bond film until Skyfall.
Skyfall, yeah.
And that's what just makes it so great. Now, at the time, 1969, five straight films with Connery. He was already a legend.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody who was going to fill his shoes would have a really, really tough time. But the great thing about perspective and reevaluation is the kind of love and respect and appreciation that On Her Majesty's Secret Service now gets. It is widely hailed as one of the best films, not just by us, mm-hmm. but by everyone.
And it's one you should watch before you see Spectre because it has a lot of connections.
Definitely
with Spectre.
Does. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was thinking about that too. But it is there's so much going on. It like basically ties all of Connery's films together with throwbacks to the gadgets and some of the themes, like somebody's whistling the Goldfinger theme in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, it brings out all the gadgets.
The wedding scene.
They change the themes.
Yeah, they keep changing the
and
themes.
And Tracy is a great Bond girl because...
Diana Rigg.
She has the most personality that we'd seen up to that point. And still, I think, one of the few that has the most substance to her.
And she also gave Bond a run for his money. She was
she
his
died.
Match. And she dies. Right. Spoiler alert, she dies. But
she's just having a rest.
You know, the
she's
thing
just
that
having a rest.
Got it to me, that the thing that got me. To me watching the movie is the end of the film. You know, before that happens, at the wedding, you know, to see Q and M happy and unguarded
mm-hmm.
with their, you know, they let their guard down and they're just happy that James Bond is getting married.
Moneypenny
is crying.
I know.
She's crying. And like when he throws his hat to her,
I know.
Like it was like, oh,
like,
poor
like
Moneypenny.
Stand. It kind of feels like an anomaly within the Bond franchise, but at the same time, it does, as you say, tie them all together. It doesn't completely disregard the other Bond movies.
Right.
And I like that, you know, tongue
this
in cheek moment
to
at the
other
start.
Guy.
Yeah,
yeah,
just that look
so
down
great.
The barrel of the camera. A little
and of course,
wink.
Great music by John Barry and a great theme song, We Have All the Time in the World, by Louis Armstrong, the last theme he ever recorded before he passed away. But yeah, Diana Rigg was so great because she was on TV's The Avengers. So
yeah.
She already had that set up as in the spy world.
Uh-huh.
And poor Moneypenny, always the bridesmaid,
never
the bride.
I feel so sorry for her.
But a couple of interesting reviews, not from critics, but from filmmakers.
Yes.
Like Steven Soderbergh.
I wrote that one down.
Read it.
I have Soderbergh says it's beautiful in a way that none of the other Bond films are. And Christopher Nolan also loves this movie
the most.
That's
what I was my other one.
Yeah.
He says it's a tremendous balance of action, scale, romanticism, tragedy, and emotion. Of course, we picked the two same ones.
Yes, of course, of course. Well, Daniel Epler says, On Her Majesty's Secret Service is an unsung masterpiece. George Lazenby steps into Connery's role quite well, but it's really the script and the direction that elevates this film. It brilliantly captures who Bond really is, right down to his toughness, his charm, his womanizing, his skill with gambling. Plus, Diana Rigg is just delightful. She's my favorite Bond girl, and clearly Bond's as well, as she's the only one he married. And all that makes the ending much more painful and powerful. Great film. I know. What about the Louis Armstrong film? We have all the time in the world.
We have all the time in the world. It's a great theme. It's different than all the other themes that followed it or that preceded it and followed it. And let's see. Steven Trotter says, the best Bond film is the most overlooked of the series, not by profiles. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, it delivers such a fascinating look at Bond as we watch him fall in love while on a personal mission to track down his arch nemesis, Blofeld. The action is so fluid and well-directed, but perfectly matched with so many character personal and quieter moments that really give us a look into Bond as a character. Diana Rigg is such a fantastic Bond girl with self-determination and personality that make her so much more than the typical Bond girl. The film could have had her as the main character and it would have been just as interesting and entertaining. Well, thank you, Steven Trotter.
And watching live on YouTube, people are talking about who they'd like to see as the next Bond if Daniel Craig does indeed retire.
How many people say Idris Elba?
I haven't seen an Idris Elba. I have seen Arkham City Rules says hope it's Michael Fassbender. Morgan Robinson says I heard rumors of Damian Lewis. And Patrick Beatty says Tom Hardy could be cool too. But Joshua Price makes a good point. Says, to be honest, most Bonds are unknowns before the role, so they should try to do that again.
It's actually a really, really good idea. I mean, who would you... Like, what known actor would you want to get? Yeah, just get someone new.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of Idris. I think he's stylish.
Well, we already talked about the best Bond themes. Yes. We're going through the best Bond movies. What about the best Bond girls?
Best Bond girls. Well, we talked about Tracy, played by Diana Rigg, as one with the most substance to her. I also like, despite her unfortunate name, Pussy Galore, played by Honor Blackman and Goldfinger, because she has some skills. You know, she's a pilot. She has the flying circus. She says no to Bond for a while, and then he pretty much forces her to say yes. But anyway, Honey Rider by Ursula Andress.
She's the first.
Dr. No, that bikini.
That entrance.
She's looking at the shells.
By the way, Ursula Andress actually helped design that white bikini?
Oh, did she?
Yes. I guess if you're going to make an entrance like that, you want to have some control over it.
Super famous.
That entrance. Moneypenny, my Naomi Harris in
Eve.
Skyfall. She's just Eve in the beginning of the film. And then you get to the end and you realize she's Moneypenny. You're like, this Moneypenny doesn't mess around. She is a woman of action.
I just wish they'd get her back out to the field.
Yes.
Yeah, because the way we'll talk about Skyfall, but the way that opens with her, like, in there driving, being a badass, taking a shot, and then you see her in the rest of the movie and in Spectre, no spoilers, but not really doing much, just in the background. So I want to see her, like, kicking butt again.
Who else you got?
Vesper Lynn
from Casino Royale.
Ava Green.
Nice.
Casino Royale. She's smart and sexy. And I also have to say I liked Jinx Johnson, Halle Berry.
She was good.
Another Day.
It's a good film.
Cool. She came. She had her own bikini scene.
Yes, that was a tribute. To Dr. No, which came out 40 years before. And I know that this is not even close to being one of my favorite Bonds, Vito a Kill. But I do love Grace Jones as May Day. She talk about a woman who could kick ass. You don't want to mess with her.
Yes.
Vito a Kill, a last movie from Roger Moore.
What about Xena on a top? It's a Famke Janssen
from
GoldenEye.
GoldenEye.
Uses sex as a weapon. And then there's some, you know, unfortunate names. Miss Mary Goodnight, Dr. Holly Goodhead.
Dr. Goodhead.
And Octopussy. And then Dr. Christmas Jones, played
Denise
by
Richards.
Denise Richards.
The World Is Not Enough from 99. Yeah. That was the first Bond movie I ever reviewed.
Oh, really?
I liked Pierce Brosnan's movies. I definitely thought GoldenEye and Die Another Day were the better ones. But coming down to number two.
Yes,
on our Fast Five is a big one.
See what she's done to you. Well, she never tied me to a chair.
Her loss.
Wow. Skyfall, directed by Sam Mendes, released in November 9th, 2012. 5 Oscar nominations, including cinematography, music, sound mixing. It won 2 for editing and song. Adele, of course. It's the most nominated Bond film. Cost around $200 million to make. Total box office worldwide, $1.1 billion worldwide. The only Bond film as of now to pass the 1 billion mark. I think Spectre will come close to that, if not pass it. And what a perfect way to celebrate the 50th anniversary, James.
Yeah,
Bond.
Perfect way. It's the 23rd Bond film, Daniel Craig's third, the first directed by Sam Mendes. And that Silver, played by Javier Bardem, he's
great
a
villain.
Truly terrifying villain. Funny at times. He has a personal vendetta against M. This is a very personal Bond film for all the characters involved. You get to learn more about Bond's past, although they do seem to completely wipe out the previous movies and just be like, let's start again with like his background.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing is that this, to me, Skyfall felt more like a reboot for Bond than Casino Royale did.
Yeah, I agree. And it feels kind of like a standalone Bond film almost. I mean, there's obviously returning characters, but yeah, it's one that has standalone. Does bring back Moneypenny and Q though, and it has the best cinematography.
Roger Deakins.
Incredible. The best acting, and I thought a really, really interesting plot. Very well written, particularly that scene, that long monologue that Silver does about rats.
Oh, so great. So Javier Bardem, Oscar winner, obviously, for No Country for Old Men.
And Sam Mendes was the first Oscar-winning director to direct a James Bond film.
Now, because this came out on the 50th anniversary of Bond, when I wrote my review, I wrote 50 reasons why Skyfall was the best Bond movie
You're
since Goldfinger. Not going to read them all, but just maybe a couple. The brilliant, clever, funny, and fresh screenplay effectively pays tribute to Bond's past, his present, and his future, and resets the series for the next 50 years while still working as a standalone story, like you just said. It depicts James Bond as a vulnerable, flawed hero, both physically and emotionally, thanks to a final act that makes Skyfall the most moving Bond installment since 1969's On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
This is more of a broken Bond as well. You see him, he literally comes back from the dead to come back, and he's not physically fit. He doesn't pass all the tests, but he's kind of one step behind Silver, but he ends up beating him in the end, but it takes a lot. It's a lot of loss in there. Old dog, new tricks.
Old dog, new tricks, but it was also one where I really felt like Daniel Craig really owned the role.
Yeah.
Where I really felt like this is the reason why he is the best Bond since Connery, even though I still love Roger Moore, but he is the best one since Connery.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I just appreciate Moore because I grew up with him. But, yeah. You know, and then listen, Thomas Newman, who's an amazing composer, he composed things like American Beauty. He also composed a theme for Spectre. Mm-hmm. His Bond theme just felt like a John Barry score. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful film, Skyfall, and I really liked watching it again. It's like, what, 2 hours, 30 minutes, pretty much?
Yes.
Almost?
Up
220?
Up until Spectre, it's the longest running, 220.
But it didn't feel the length at all.
It
just whizzed by. So
yeah.
Much fun. Gabrielle Sales says, Skyfall was my favorite Bond film for oh so many reasons. It's Daniel Craig really coming into his own as James Bond, helmed by the always fantastic Sam Mendes. Also, Roger Deakins, the first cinematographer I knew by name, is at the top of his game. The action was tremendous. The villain was great. Also, Adele hit it out of the park with the theme song.
And Billy Pollihan says that, to quote Scott Nance, you couldn't have asked for a better way to celebrate the 50th anniversary of James Bond, proving once again that nobody does it better indeed. It looks like somebody read my review, which is a shock. This was the Bond that many people were really surprised to see so well. Everything in this film is what a modern Bond film should have been, with a great story dealing with the threat of cyber terrorism, beautifully shot action, and of course, top-notch performances from everyone, with the best being Daniel Craig and Dame Judi Dench. Villain was really terrifying, not surprising, as Javier Bardem won the Oscar playing a terrifying villain in No Country for Old Men. But one of the best additions is the music written by Thomas Newman and Adele that sets the tone perfectly while also being very catchy. Nobody does it better indeed, and whatever comes next is sure to be delightful. Hashtag film geek, hashtag profile for life, hashtag Bond fanatic.
Well, Billy Pollihan on One Live YouTube says that, did you expect exploding pens? Which, of course, is a quote from Skyfall when Q is introduced again, and Q is played by Ben Whishaw. Very young. And then he gives him just the simple things, and he's like, what, did you expect exploding pens? I thought those little nods to classic Bond was really well done, because Sam Mendes is such a Bond fan himself. Caitlin Bond says she's seeing Spectre this weekend. Can't wait to see it. Arkham City Rules says, my favourite scene from Skyfall was the word association game Bond was doing. You could see the personal Bond come out of him.
And speaking of Bonds, we are joined right now by one of the actors to play James Bond in our third very best James Bond movie of all time, on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Joining us now, please welcome George Lazenby, is joining us on Profiles. Mr. Lazenby, you are on Profiles with Alicia and Scott. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Yay! Hey, George Lazenby. Yes, we have James Bond on the line. Mr. Lazenby, we are so happy that you're joining us on Profiles. On Her Majesty's Secret Service is just one of the very best James Bond films of all time. You're on Profiles with Scott and Alicia. Tell us why you think this film still holds up as one of the best Bond movies ever.
Well, I could say because I was in it.
Well, we agree.
Yeah.
And now it's one of the best books on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And when I was a Bond fan back when Dr. No came out. And I read all the Bond books, and I remember reading on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and I was crying when she got shot.
Oh, yeah.
And in the film, I was crying with these huge crocodile tears, and Peter Hunt, the director, who I didn't get along with, said, James Bond doesn't cry, cut the tears. So it wasn't as good an end scene as I could have made it.
I love that scene. We were just talking about that before. It's such a personal scene. It's so romantic. It's the emotional Bond that we don't get to see very often. But can you tell us about when you first met the producers and how you came to be cast as James Bond? By the way, I'm excited because I'm talking to the Aussie Bond.
Yeah, you got an Australian here.
Well, to cut a long story short, a friend of mine wanted to go out with a casting director because he wanted to be an actor. And I'd never acted or spoken in front of a camera in my life. I'd done some male modeling, and he was a male model as well. And he said, could you do me a favor? My girlfriend's come back into town. I've got a date with his casting director. She's an agent, and she's the biggest agent in London. I said, sure. So I took her to a screening, because that's how all the famous people see movies in those days. And there was the Rolling Stones and John Lennon and Mick Jagger. And I'm looking at all these people thinking, wow, I'd never been that close to any famous person. And I won't tell you what happened, but about a week later, I went back to Paris and she called me going into a girl's place that I didn't even know I was going into that night. And she answered the phone and says, Patou, meaning you. And I said, who could it be? And it's Maggie Abbott, this agent from London. She said, you got to get back to London straight away. They're having trouble finding this part for a guy that's just like you are. And I said, what do you mean? Like me? Well, he's got that self-assurance kind of arrogance you have. And I said, what's the role? She said, well, I can't tell you on the phone. You got to come back. So I hung up and forgot about it. And then I got back to London, and Ken Garrity, the guy that set me up with the date, said, what did Maggie want you for? I said, I don't know. She called me and wouldn't tell me, so I didn't bother going and see her. She said, come on, let's go see her. And we went over to her office, and she made Ken wait outside while she told me what the role was. And anyway, I went to the casting people, and I couldn't get into casting because I wasn't in the union. So they threw me out, and I said, Maggie, they won't let me in. She said, of course they won't. You've got to get in. Get into Dyson Lovell's office. And so meanwhile, I saw the guys all had short hair. I had long hair and sideburns at this stage. And so I went and got my hair cut where Connery got his hair cut.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I knew where it was because I used to be a car salesman on that street. And Kurt the barber, he told me that Connery comes in here from time to time. So I went there, and that's when Cubby Broccoli was sitting in a seat behind me, and he made up a story that I was discovering in a barber shop. He didn't even remember that he saw me there, but he did say to Kurt the barber that that guy would make a good Bond as I was walking out. He's probably a successful businessman because I'd already gotten one of Connery's suits, a Rolex watch, and his haircut.
That's awesome.
Well, what was it?
So I waited till the girl ducked under a desk for something. And I screamed past her up the stairs, and I leaned against the door of Dyson Lovell's office. Now, if he hadn't have been talking to Harry Saltzman at the time on the phone, I wouldn't have got past him because he's quite clever. He's a casting director. He would have found out I was not an actor. So I just stood there with my arms folded with my Rolex showing, and he was on the phone. He put his hand over the mouthpiece. He said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I heard you're looking for James Bond."
Wow.
That's so smooth.
And he said, "Harry, there's a guy here, blah, blah, blah." And Harry said, "Bring him over." So anyway, I went over to his office, and I started to get a little nervous because he was a really tough guy, Harry Saltzman. And he pointed to a chair in front of his feet. He had his feet up on the desk. And I thought, screw that. I'm not going to sit down in that chair. His feet are right there. So I went over and looked out the window because he was on the phone. And then he got off the phone. He came over to me and he said, "Tell me your life story." And I just told Dyson Lovell all this baloney about me being an actor in Hungary and China and places I thought they couldn't check on. And he says, "I just told him, let him tell you." And he told me later, those two things really got his attention. Because normally if he points to something, the actor will jump there and go there. Or he says, "What do? You'll spill out all this dialogue." And I just said, "I just told him, let him tell you." Because I couldn't remember what I told him. It was all lies.
What was it like to follow? I mean, you know, you're talking about playing Bond, but you had to follow Sean Connery, who played him five times. I mean, were you inhibited by that at all? Were you nervous, or were you just like, "Yeah, let's go for it"?
This is may sound egotistical, but I didn't even think of it. I thought when I got the job, which was after 4 months of testing, it's the biggest film test in history, by the way. They saw 3,000 odd guys and 300 tested on film, and it went on for years, you know. So, and then I come along and I can't even speak English, you know. I had an Australian accent. "G'day, mate, how are you?" I used to sway when I walked, and it was no good for film because you just go right across the screen every time you move. And so, in CinemaScope. So meanwhile, I had to change my walk, change my accent, and get them to accept a male model. They thought they'd be the laughing stock of the industry if they gave the job to me. And but Peter Hunt, who I was still talking to at that stage, he said, "No, I want this guy. He's perfect." Because he could also tell me what to do. I didn't know what to do. And I did all my own stunts except the serious skiing, where the insurance company canceled me out for skiing because that was in the script. But all the rest, the stunts, I did all the fighting, all the jumping from heights and all that stuff.
Wow.
And the stuntman said to Peter Hunt one day, "You can hurt this guy." He said, "That's fine. We hurt him, we get another shot with someone else."
Well, we're talking about that last scene. What do you remember about working with Diana Rigg?
Diana?
Yeah.
Well, Diana and I had a funny situation. I used to be a chess player with my uncle. He was bedridden, and her boyfriend was a chess guy. And we're in his place one day, and he said, "Do you play chess?" I said, "Sure." So he was walking around the room casually while I was checkmating him. He said, "What?" So he sat down, then took a serious go at me, and he still couldn't beat me. He threw the board up in the air. And I think that impressed Diana, because before that, she thought, "Who is this Yahoo from Australia?"
Yeah.
And then we got to Switzerland. She said, "You know, you want to have anything to do with me, you're not to mess around with any of the other girls." I thought, fair enough, but I didn't have any intention of not messing around with the other girls. So she caught me out, put it that way, and that was the end of our romance.
Wow.
And, yeah, we just worked together.
But
Peter Hunt, you know, told her and Telly to help me out with my acting. And after I did the first scene, they just said, "He doesn't need any help." I don't know whether they didn't want to help me or they thought I didn't need any help. But they never gave me any tips.
Well, what were the scenes that were the most challenging to film? I mean, this is a very physical role. I mean, you got the fist fights, you got the car chase, you got the bobsled chase, you got the skiing scene. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, to go from
and the emotional scene
and the emotional scenes the too. It's physically and emotionally grueling. Like, what was the most challenging scene to film, and what were your favorites?
Well, the first scene was shot after 6 months of shooting. The first scene you see in the movie, where I'm fighting on the beach. Mm-hmm. We'd already done 6 months in Switzerland. That was in Portugal. I did 6 weeks in Portugal. Well, 3 months, 6 weeks there and 6 weeks in the studio. So it was a 9 month shoot. And I was, Peter Hunt and I didn't get along. That's another story. But he would only give me one take on each angle. And I'd say that was a terrible. I was terrible in that scene, Peter. He'd say, don't worry, we're covering it for another shot, another angle. And so I just went through it the best I could. I didn't have any nervousness about it for some reason, probably because I didn't know whether I was good or bad or indifferent. I just did what I did.
Hmm.
And I know I went to 20 years of acting classes afterwards.
Wow.
And I know I could have done it a lot better if I had that experience, but I didn't. So, apart from they taught me how to breathe, how to speak English, how to walk, occasionally I'd fall into my old style and Peter Hunt would say, tell him to walk like Prince Philip, for God's sake. And I'd be staggering down the hallway. Because, I don't walk that way, I don't talk that way normally, but I did get I can do accents now. I can do American or English or Australian, not mm-hmm. that anyone cares or ever wanted me to do. I thought I was a first-class actor after 20 years of training, but nobody hired me. I was sort of forgotten about.
Oh, well, we love watching you as James Bond on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and people are watching live now and they're really excited to hear from you. And one question that people want to know is, what is your personal favorite James Bond film? Do you have one that you like to watch?
I like Goldfinger and obviously Dr. No, because it's the first one. I'll tell you a funny story. I was in Canberra, Australia.
Yeah, it's where I'm from. It's where I was born.
Oh, my gosh. How cool
is
that?
Really?
Yeah.
And I went to the Manica Cinema there to see Dr. No in 1962, and I went in with this girl who I had 90% chance of getting lucky with going in
wow.
and 10% coming out because she'd seen Sean Connery. He blew her away. And I thought, if ever that job comes up,
that's so
look
fun.
Out. Yeah, and...
Good old Monica.
Well, listen, we're so grateful that you took the time to call in and discuss your time as Bond with us here on Profiles. George Lazenby, thank you so much, very, very much, for calling in the Profiles. We are so, so grateful. Have a great, great day, and thank you so much.
It was fun talking about myself.
Thank you. We loved hearing it. Thank you so much. Bye.
All the best to you.
Bye, Sol. Thank profile. You so much.
Bye.
Cheers.
Yay! Bond, I love the Aussie wit.
Look what he was talking about.
Yeah, I love it. I didn't even know he was in Canberra at one time. I mean, I wasn't born then, but that was my parents were probably there. That's crazy. And
that's
I used to go to Manuka
cool.
Cinema all the time to watch movies. And I really do love seeing George Lazenby as Bond. I mean, it's one time, one shot. I wish he had another chance to come back.
Definitely, yeah.
And I love how he seems like James Bond, talking about getting lucky with girls yeah. and, like, going off and being like, I hear you're looking for James Bond. Like, that's awesome. I love those little anecdotes.
And again, like the way
getting
that...
getting his hair cut like Sean Connery. That's great.
I feel like the way people have come to reevaluate that film and his performance, just because there was so much pressure and to follow Connery.
Yeah.
And now people see, not so long is it a great film, but his performance was actually really, really good, especially
yeah.
given the circumstance.
Given,
but
yeah.
so were other actors in other James Bond films,
yes.
which brings us to the others. Let's show some love to Pierce Brosnan, shall we?
Yeah, well, you can say GoldenEye.
GoldenEye, yes.
GoldenEye 1995, which was Pierce Brosnan's first, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it felt fresh. even though, you know, they had a lot of I really liked the way, as you mentioned before, how M says you're a Cold War relic.
Yep.
It's really about whether Bond is still viable relevant. In today's day. Relevant, that's what I was looking for in today's day and age. I love that.
Well, it was a Bond film that for a whole new generation, it was a return to form after the Dalton years, because the two films that he did, you know, they have their admirers and their appreciators, but I don't think the Dalton films are strong as the Brosnan ones.
Mm-hmm.
Director Martin Campbell directed this reboot. He also directed Gold... Casino Royale.
Yay!
Yeah, as a Daniel Craig's reboot.
That's right.
But what are some of the other Bonds?
Well, I was going to say Casino Royale is excellent. It was a big reboot, a fresh start for James Bond, Martin Campbell. They ditched the silly jokes and misogyny for Bourne-like, you know, grittiness, and he falls in love. I really liked that. And I think after Austin Powers, they couldn't do the tongue-in-cheek humor. I think it's taken them a while to figure out how to weave humor back in. Spectre is another one that's in the others list, and that has a little bit more humor.
That has more humor, too. I don't think Spectre is as good as Skyfall, but I still think it holds its own. I think it's better than Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
Not as good as Casino Royale or Skyfall. Worth seeing if you haven't seen Spectre, please do so. I think you'll enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But one Bond film that I have to say that I love, that I think a lot of people really hate,
what's
is
that?
Moonraker.
Moonraker. I actually like it. It's so
Moonraker.
Cheesy, it's, but it's fun.
It's so
good
cheesy.
Fun.
It's so
Jaws.
Fun. I love that line. He goes,
space.
Drax. He says, look after Mr. Bond.
Yeah.
See that some harm comes to him.
Yeah.
You know, he's like the classic, you know,
evil
Bond
villain.
You know, and this, that line, we're on the gondola, and he's with Dr. Goodhead, and he sees Jaws coming the other way, and he goes, his name's Jaws. He kills people.
Yeah.
So fun.
It's really cheesy, really fun.
Bob
I also
space.
Like License to Kill from 1989, Timothy Dalton. It was his second movie, but this feels more like a revenge story than a 007 adventure.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a Bond movie.
It's you know, it's all about Felix's wife gets murdered, his new wife, and then they go after him. So it does feel a lot smaller than some of the big Bond movies, and it's nice to have all those different flavors.
Another nod for Roger Moore for Your Eyes Only, 1981. After Moonraker was such a bloated film, it was also a very successful movie, James Bond in Space. There was a lot of pressure to bring Bond back to basics, make him real and gritty again.
Mm-hmm.
And For Your Eyes Only was the only Roger Moore movie that really, really did that in an effective way. It was Roger Moore's most physical turn as Bond, which is also the reason why it was his least favorite to film.
Because it was tough. Also, Tomorrow Never Dies, 1997, Pierce Brosnan. I think that is his personal best Bond, although I think his best movie is GoldenEye. I really like Michelle Yeoh and her butt-kicking moves. Like,
yeah.
She did all her own stunts, and she was really cool.
She upstaged Bond.
For sure.
She was great in that.
Yeah.
Of course, we talked about Dr. No, because it was the one that started it all.
The first Bond film.
Can you imagine it's 1962, and you're going in to see a film just like this for the very first time, and you have no idea what to expect?
Yeah.
I was trying to put myself in that mind
Sean.
Frame watching it again. Like, forget every Bond movie you ever saw. Watch this with a fresh set of eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it, first of all, it holds up really well.
And
it looks great.
But I wouldn't have thought that it would be 24 films, 50-something years later,
yeah,
that people would still be coming out and seeing
still
Bond films.
Doing it.
It's so crazy. Well, on our Facebook page, we had the brackets run this week by Billy Pollahan. They did a couple of things. The first one they did was the best James Bond film. It came down to Casino Royale versus Goldfinger. What do you think won?
Goldfinger.
Casino Royale.
No way.
Which isn't even in our Fast Five.
Body young profilers.
Sorry, guys, but profilers like Casino Royale as the best James Bond film. They also voted on the best theme song, and it was Live and Let Die, and the best henchman, which was Odd Job.
Oh, they did choose Live and Let Die?
Yeah, they chose
it. All right.
Yeah, they chose that. Odd Job, they
nice.
Chose as their best henchman. Best villain was Blofeld. They were also doing Best Bond Girl, but I didn't get to see the results. So go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/profiles with Malone and Mance, and you'll get to see all the little brackets and fun competitions that they did with each
and
other.
And make sure you like our Facebook page while you're at Profiles with Malone and Mance, because
yes.
We love when people like our Facebook page. And, well, this brings us to our number one movie in our Fast Five.
Which is...
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
The delivery. No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Goldfinger.
Goldfinger, released on September 18th in the UK, 1964, cost $3 million, up from $2 million from Russia with Love. Box office worldwide, $125 million.
Woo.
In 1964. You could buy an island with that. One Oscar win for best effects and sound effects. And this is the movie where Bond really hit his stride. It got everything right. It set everything up. It took it to the next level. The better gadgets, the better car, the better music. It's a crazier villain. Right.
Very eccentric supervillain and Auric Goldfinger. And his eccentric sidekick, Odd Job. He doesn't speak at all. It's got, you know, the great Bond girl with Pussy Galore. She has skills. She has the flying, what were they called? Pussy Galore's Flying Circus. She has her flying circus team. It also has the really ridiculous plot of Goldfinger, who wants to contaminate the U.S. gold supply in Fort Knox so that he has more. But that underground lair and that moment, like from the clip before, the laser moment. I mean, it's such a classic Bond moment because he tells him his entire plot. He gives him plenty of time to escape, and then he manages to cut it off just before he gets
singed. The villains that followed never learned.
They never learned.
Oh, well, since you're going to die anyway, I will tell you everything.
I'm going to tell you everything. And then what about that poor guy that gets squished in the metal?
Oh, gosh.
The car crusher.
What about, it's all about the quotes. You got some good ones in here, like the one we just kicked in with. But I love serving Dom Perignon above 38 degrees. It's like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
Yeah, I'm sure you liked that
one. I love that line.
I also like the elaborate death of the Bond girl painted in gold skin. That's suffocation.
Iconic image.
Yeah, it's an iconic image, but it's not real.
It doesn't exist.
And I like how they explain, well, it's the painting, it's the gold that they use for the painters, but they usually have to leave a small patch on the bottom of the feet for their skin to breathe.
Right.
But when they don't, they die.
But that image
is classic.
Shirley Eaton covered in the gold like that is one of the most enduring images of cinema, period. Mm-hmm. This is Steven Spielberg's favorite James Bond movie, and Sean Connery himself had this to say about Goldfinger. Years ago, he was interviewed, and he says, "I heard my voice from a TV, and my grandchildren were watching Goldfinger. I watched it for a bit, and it was interesting. There was an elegance, an assurance, and a leisureliness to it that was comforting. I also saw things that I would have improved in a heartbeat."
Well, Josh Price says, "For me, Goldfinger remains the greatest and stands as the benchmark from which all other Bonds are measured against. It epitomizes what makes the franchise so great and why it still endures to this day. The film is rife with multiple iconic images, from Jill Masterson's gold-covered body to the laser beam pointed at Bond. Connery seems to embody the role with a sense of gruff sleekness," I like that, "and smooth toughness. When you think of James Bond, you think of saving the world, seductresses, eccentric villains, and nifty gadgets. In other words, you think of Goldfinger."
Absolutely.
And just, I like that description of Connery, because I was reading that when they cast Sean Connery as Bond, they said they wanted someone who was big and tough, like a big man, hulking man, but also moved like a cat. So he is that sleek but tough.
He's kind of, rewatching those Connery movies. He's the man. And Seb Lacey closes it out for us by saying, "Goldfinger is my favorite of the classic Bond films. It is everything that made James Bond 007. From the introduction where Bond dispatches an assassin with quick thinking and a cool quip." By the way, that opening scene when he switches from a scuba gear to a white tux. That's such an iconic image.
Remember
True Lies?
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger paid a big tribute to that with James Cameron in that one.
The white tux.
With the white tux to the end where Goldfinger gets his comeuppance. And yes, it's a little dated in some areas, but it's still a brilliant film. Casino Royale may have made Bond cool, but Goldfinger is really where Bond started.
All right, let's do a rapid round of business before we go.
Take it away.
Subscribe to Profiles on iTunes. Don't forget to rate and review. You can watch us live on YouTube every second Tuesday at youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork. Also, all the episodes are there. So if you haven't seen all of Profiles, make sure you go and watch all the episodes right there. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/profiles with Malone Mance. Thanks. You can get Profiles t-shirts on
tpublic.com/user/ /profiles.
And then you can follow us on Twitter at Alicia Malone, at Scott Mann, the Movie Man.
After all this, all these years.
At Movie Man.
All these years.
At Alicia Malone, at Movie Man.
That's all about the pause anyway.
I'm so tired today, I'm sure you can tell.
Well, Woo! We're going to wrap it up by recalling our Fast Five. Coming in at number five is The Spy Who Loved Me. Number four, From Russia with Love. Number three,
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Number two, Skyfall. And number one, Goldfinger. The book is closed. Profiles is done. But make sure you share profiles with everyone, and we'll be back in two weeks.
Who are we going to do next? We have to think.
We have someone in mind, someone really special, someone that Profiles is all about. As for who that person is, check back in a couple of days and go to our Facebook page so you can be the first to find out who our next profile is, but you will not be disappointed. You will love it.
We're figuring it out.
Until next time, bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Christian Harloff, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.